I'm going to read a little book, a little bit from this book I did about Apple several years ago. Sometimes people say, what do you do? And I have a hard time answering that. I do a fair amount of radio for public radio and books. And generally the categories are, I usually say, sex, food, science, and farming. Food and farming are probably best what we stick to here. But there's a link amidst them all, and it has to do, as Rick Bragg was saying, about sin and temptation, and there's no finer fruit, it seems to me, for either. I don't really believe in sin, but I do believe in temptation and appetite, and I think that's what connects them. When you get these sheets, they're going to have the list of a number of apples. Find the apple on the plate that goes by, because it won't be in the order that we started. We're sort of chopping them up too quickly. And there are three categories. Give me more and more. Oh, all right. Or what Tom Burford called a quick spitter. There's a lot of nostalgia about so-called heirloom fruits and vegetables, and I share a certain amount of it. But I borrow a page from Tom Burford, who said, well, you know, it's true. If you looked in the catalogs, the regional and local catalogs for apples in 1870, and you put them all together, you would have found about 800 varieties. And now you can easily get about 15. Well, 15 isn't enough, but Burford has an explanation about why they're not 800. And that's because most of them, he said, fell into the category of quick spitters. You bite into them and you spit them out quick. And there's some quick spitters in this group of apples you're getting here, so don't be timid. What I thought I'd do is tell you a little bit from this book, which is called Apples, Story of the Fruit of Temptation. It looks at the origins of the edible apple, which comes from Kazakhstan. This is inconvenient for some religions, but it's true. And the apples that we eat, there are gazillions of varieties of apples in the world. The apples that we eat made their way to what used to be Iraq, I suppose, the Fertile Crescent, in the bellies of mules, and the people who were going along with them as they marched their way eventually toward the Mediterranean and up through Europe and across the ocean. First apples that were brought to this country were in the early 17th century in Long Island. But that's a long way from Appalachia. Our orchard, which still loses money in northeastern Kentucky, but has managed to survive, is a small retail operation. Where I grew up, and I'm just going to read you a little bit about what that was like. There was one other apple grower, by the way, he was two ridges away, and an apple that he discovered on his farm, that's how most apples that you eat came to be, they were discovered on a tree that wasn't supposed to be there. It's called a Razor Russet, and his name was Razor. We and Mr. Razor, who was one ridge away, were always seen by our neighbors as somehow a touch strange. They were so slightly suspect. It seemed to have to do with pleasure. No one else in our part of the world grew anything for money that gave so much plain delight. And we hadn't even started fermenting yet. The annual act of taking that first apple, roundish, blushed with crimson, the flesh beneath its skin firm and sturdy and ready to explode upon the tongue, announced by a fragrance so clear and subtle that the memory centers deep within the brain let loose an avalanche of nearly forgotten summer tastes, memories that are themselves inseparable from the expectations of eager youth. This plain act of snapping the fruit from the branch or lifting it from a wooden crate and drawing it up toward the ready mouth was an affirmation of the senses. To eat into the apple, to press the edge of the teeth past the taut, unwilling skin into ready white meat, to feel the spray of tart and honeyed spices rain down against the tongue and wash over the palate, was to know again how exquisite are the treasures of the ordinary earth. Apple season, not the apples of summer best left for sauce pots and jelly jars, but the apples that fall in September and October, when the sun is sliding south, is the time for harvest mischief, the time of last temptation before the cold and darkness. And the growers are the agents of that temptation. And I'll get a little further about how the preachers dealt with that, because they were always tempted. And if they weren't tempted, what was the point? You can understand all that on Sunday afternoons. And as I suspect is probably true in most of the South, there were blue laws in the 50s. A lot of people here can remember the 50s, where nothing could be sold. We were, in fact, the only business that was not shut down except for Sunday mornings at one drugstore. Even the gas stations were closed. And for that reason, it was a bit troublesome for many people, because Sunday was always the day to come to buy apples. Sunday was the day to come to buy apples all over America. And why has to do with a lot of the things you've been talking here about today, the traditions of what happens on particular days of the week in the work schedule. So along with the hundreds of other country and city people who would rattle up the rutted mountainside road to our orchard, they came with their families, and they'd park under the oak trees, they'd get out of the cars, and they'd amble into our dirt-floored sales shed. It's concrete now, health department, you know. No matter how full the outside air was with dust and goldenrod pollen, inside the shed, the perfume of fresh apples was overwhelming. "Whoa, sure does smell like apples," they'd say. "Land's mercy, never saw so many apples," even though most of them had been coming there for 15 or 20 years, and it smelled the same every year and looked about the same, but that was the kind of ritual that people would always say. And in those days, the apples were contained in wooden bushel crates. The varieties are many of the varieties we have here, some of which you can find in grocery stores. Jonathan's, Cortland's, Grimes Golden. Golden and Red Delicious. Does anybody here like a Red Delicious that they've ever gotten in a store? Well, that's good. I have some store-bought Red Delicious here, but we may not end up distributing them. What we do have, though, is what the Red Delicious started out its life to be in Kansas, called the Hawkeye. And it's a pinkish, creamy-colored apple with red stripes. And it won all kinds of prizes, and it made the Stark Brothers Nursery in Missouri very, very rich, until they went bankrupt a few years ago. But that's a very perfumey Red Delicious, really sweet and full of flavor, and it'll be passing around. And it's called, properly speaking, a Hawkeye, and comes from the 19th century. Others of the old apples that you're going to be tasting are relative. Well, the oldest apple we have up here is a golden russet, which is from the early 17th century. Or at least it's thought to be a golden russet. It was a golden russet in England, and it was supposed to be a golden russet by the time it got to Long Island and loaded off, and it might be. And nobody can say for sure, but that's probably the oldest. Another old one you'll be seeing is called Spitzenberg, or more properly, is Sophius Spitzenberg, which was Jefferson's favorite table apple. And then the last one of the old varieties is called the Hughes Crab, which was one of Jefferson's favorite hard cider apples. But more about that as we go on. On those Sunday afternoons, the preachers would walk in after church to choose their apples. Ordinary customers would mill about for 15 or 20 minutes, sniffing, punching, peeling, slicing the fruit, making their selections, and then they'd carry their bounty off to their cars and pickups and gunny sacks or big brown paper bags tied with twine. The preachers would do the same thing up to the point of purchase. But it was Sunday. So they'd ask us to set their apples aside in the back room, and they'd come back on Monday to pay for them and collect them. But the choices would always be made on Sunday, because they wanted to make sure nobody else got the variety they wanted, and it might be gone the next day. And surely the good Lord wouldn't mind just a little wayfaring. As a practical matter, Sunday was the only day that most country people were able to come to buy apples. Until the 1960s, in our part of Kentucky, few women drove cars at all, and their husbands were busy on work days. Farm work started usually about 6:30, 7 o'clock in the morning, ended well after sundown. And inside the household, the regimens were strict. Monday was wash day. I still, if I remember, wash my clothes on Monday. One of those habits. Saturday was town day, and each square, Flemingsburg was the town, and each square, of which there were only two, not a lot to choose from, was packed with men and women and men in denim overalls, and they were standing around jawing, telling stories while their wives bought groceries. Men in a supermarket in our part of Kentucky in 1956, you wouldn't see them. My father wouldn't even go in. They would sit quietly in the car while the women went inside and got what they did, and occasionally would deign to come in and carry the sacks of groceries out to the car. Saturday night was, of course, bath night. And on our ridge, there were only three houses with running water. Ours was one. We had a, before there was electricity, we had a diesel electricity system. But generally, it was the big galvanized steel tub that was filled up and used at least three times, three people per filling. And that was Saturday and Saturday night. Sunday, of course, was church and chicken dinner and the time to drive out to the mountain to get apples. City people came from Lexington or Cincinnati. They took the day as an autumn outing. They usually bought anywhere from a peck. We talked about pecks before. Nobody much anymore remembers what a peck is. And they'd buy anywhere from a peck to sometimes a bushel or a bushel and a half. But the country people, who were most of our customers, packed off from 2 to 10 bushels of apples in these big bags. And often they'd return a month later for a like amount for keeping all winter. So Sunday was the practical day to buy apples. But there was something else. Because it was Sunday, and because the apples were both wholesome and primordially forbidden, the whole experience bore just a trace of an illicit adventure. Driving up that scary hillside road with the sharp, steep cliffs, maybe 150 feet down, not much for real mountain people, but for our part of the world, it seemed scary to people who lived in town. And then spending money just after the sermon was over and letting the kids loose to romp in the orchard, looking over the city folk in their fancy hats and polished Pontiacs, or for the city folk pointing to the pickups and listening to the hillbilly twang, and complaining politely about how the prices seemed awful high this year, all this made coming to get apples like any other shopping experience. Most of our customers grew plums and cherries and blackberries in the backyard or along old fence rows. Bananas and oranges were store-bought food. But apples, in the 1950s at least, and good apples occupied a special place, geographically and culturally. To grow them, you had to use poisonous chemicals with odd names. Arsenate of lead, which, by the way, is organic. You wouldn't want to use it, but it is organic. Malathion, captan, and a whole variety of other quite deadly things. You also had to have special equipment to spray the chemicals onto the trees. Tobacco, the crop that most Kentucky farmers grew, was, as anybody who's ever grown it, who's here in the room knows, basically a weed. And before the era of blue mold, was a pretty easy weed to grow in terms of survival, a dreadfully hard, difficult weed to grow in terms of back pain and how many hours you put into it per year. But that's mostly what people grew in our part of Kentucky at that time. Serious apple growing, even they acknowledged, took a certain amount of book learning. And that, of course, brought to mind the lessons of Eden, which, of course, is all about the invitation to temptation. Of all the fields that farmers tend, the apple orchard seems to me about the most inviting. I'm biased. Others have their own mistakable beauty, cornfields about which we've heard a good deal. Betray geometric patterns that can be as mesmerizing as Navajo rugs. And bean fields run on in endless dark green lines against the sunburnt soil. Wheat fields press their swaying fingers to the wind. And orange groves fluff themselves up like fizzy columns of deep green porcupines. But they never show that structure. They never invite tomboys to shinny up their trunks and crawl along their bare scaffold limbs. Apple orchards wander along hillsides. They meander around boulders and make room for wet spots where trees won't grow. They encourage guests to stop in and visit a while. Once lured inside one of those trees, Visitors find fantasy hideaways full of imaginary furniture. Sturdy lower limbs become fast horses leaping from the trunk. High in the top, twisted branches make crow's nests and pirate perches, and halfway up hang the swaying wooden hammocks of August daydreams, where faces made of leaves and clouds tell tales of impossible voyages. Apple trees promise temptation to the young and fertile mind. Autumn journeys into the orchard seem to stir the memory of all those temptations to lassitude. With winter but a month away, the trek to the orchard carries just the slightest feeling of a fling. The preachers knew that too. Maybe theirs was the finest fling of all as they stepped inside the fruit shed and then concocted a transparent scheme to avoid a technical violation of the law of the Sabbath. But the biggest violators were not we in our orchards. They were our neighbors, the Muse brothers. The Muses were among the first families to come into eastern Kentucky. They claim, I never looked up the records, to have received 20,000 acres in a revolutionary land grant. But by and by, that disappeared, and what appeared in its stead, which we'll hear a little bit more about this afternoon, are a lot of moonshine stills. And some of that was apple moonshine. The Muse brother I got to know was named Asa, but no one would ever say Asa. He was always Acy. And Acy had already retired when he told me the story about his moonshining and about how when he was 14, his grandfather sent him up the hill into the woods with a .38 special and told him just to shoot anybody who came around. Don't ask questions. Acy made a lot of money, he told me, in the applejack and moonshine trade. Maybe $250,000, which in AC's life was a lot of money, even over 30 years. Maybe $250,000, a quarter of which he'd tucked away, but not in a bank. He'd never gone to jail, though he was tried 3 times. In the 40 years I made whiskey, I've been jailed 12 hours. They tore up 3 stills, and they come arrest me. I give me a good lawyer, beat them all 3 times. And then he laughed. He said he didn't like that very much. I liked AC, though. His great-grandfather, as I'd said, had inherited the 20,000 acres. But there was something about AC that always tickled my fancy about this notion of sin, if you choose to believe in sin, and temptation. Because AC was the real McCoy. He had a 15-acre orchard of mostly Red Delicious, which is an apple that has certain benefits, especially the old-fashioned ones, because they have a lot of tannin and a lot of sugar, and they make a lot of alcohol when you still it down. And that's, I think, what led me into thinking about this particular world of apples and temptation and appetite. Because in a certain sense, even though I wouldn't in any sense call myself a Christian or anything to do with that religion or any others for that matter, sin and temptation are such a part of the world most of us here grew up around. And it is, to a degree, the Muses put themselves all the way out there to be touched by it and to touch others and to be the bad boys on the ridge, just as we were the good boys in our nice little clean and neat apple orchard. And in that dynamic between the two seems to be a lot about what goes on in the world of agriculture and fruit and the lure that keeps drawing us back to these kinds of activities. They are very tempting to us, even when for the most part, and I think I'm probably accurate here, not very many people here want to spend their time actually growing things. But there's something about that lure to it that is reflected in, I think, what you're doing about exploring the cultural meaning of food and appetite and pleasure and how it takes an important place in our lives. But I don't want to go more on the moonshining, because you're going to hear lots more moonshining stories in a while. These apples that we've gotten cut. So that's my little pitch about me. We can talk about it. We can talk about heirloom apples. One of the things is a lot of apples are, well, you'll make your own judgments. Why don't we start passing them around? You have your sheets and a pen, and I can talk a little bit about each of these apples as we go. Let's start with Jonathan. Right. I'll pass some napkins around and you can spit in the napkins. How's that? I'll pass it on back. Yeah. Jonathan is one of those apples that goes back late 19th century. Most of the apples you'll find here go back to the late 19th century. They were grown in the upper Appalachians and the lower Midwest, all the way up into New England. One of the problems is that apples don't grow very well down here. There's not enough what they call cooling nights. And they winter at a cooling hours to make the bud formation work. So when we talk about Appalachian fruit, in the Department of Apples, once you get much below Knoxville, there's a problem. They don't do well. But Jonathan is one that was fairly well covered. The next one that's going to come after it is a Cortland. Cortland was a hybrid made at Cornell University, as a good many of the good apples were, in the 1915. I don't know if that qualifies as an heirloom apple or not, but it is a stepchild of a Macintosh, which doesn't grow in the South. Or you can grow it, but it won't taste very good if you try. And after that, probably the newest apple that we have here. There's two plates of these. You combine them. Well, let's take them. This one won't go very far. This is called Young America. And it also comes from Cornell. It's a crab apple. But it's a pretty tasty little crab apple, I think. You may or may not. Most crab apples you wouldn't want to eat. Technically, a crab apple is any apple less than 2 inches in diameter. And that's the only meaning there is, crabby and little. Most of the apples that were used to make cider, hard cider, in the 18th and 19th centuries, were seedlings, and they were probably crabs. When you plant an apple seed, God knows what you'll get. You know, it could be several hundred different kinds of apples that are contained in the genetic code, which is a fairly promiscuous set of genes. They move around quite a lot. But cider was made from seedlings. And why was it made from seedlings? It was made from seedlings because people didn't have money to buy nursery trees, which is the same reason in France and Spain. And in England, you find a lot of cider as well. These are the apples people could afford. They threw them out. They got some trees. The cider was good. They kept making them through grafting. Cider was, until around 1830, the primary beverage in North America. Washington and Jefferson had huge cider vats, you could call them, and did a good deal of trade in cider. Cider disappeared from the American diet because of Blue Nose Baptists, we were talking about earlier, and Methodists, and a whole lot of people in the Midwest, really, not so much in the lower South. People in the Appalachian South and Virginia had more sense until they were sort of driven out of business. Cider was a way to keep the apple through the winter. Children drank cider, adults drank cider. Children drank weak cider, which would come from the second pressing. You grind up the apples, you press them, you make a juice, and then you've got the lees, you would say, in winemaking terms. But then you can re-infuse that with water, and you get a second pressing where the alcohol will never come up to more than 2%. When I was doing this book, I was talking to a wonderful lady in her 80s who lived, what was interesting, before the war, she told me, there were 40 people working on the farm, and they were paid, serf-like, with their house, a small amount of money, the garden, and each day they were given 3 bottles of cider to take to the fields. The same kinds of things happened in Virginia in the 18th century, too. That was weak cider. They'd have a whole bottle of cider for mid-morning break, a whole bottle for lunch, and a whole bottle for afternoon break. It maybe wasn't the most efficient phase of French agriculture, but it was how that worked. And cider was often a kind of currency of the realm. It disappeared with the arrival of German immigration. Germans liked beer. Germans went to the cities. And grain was transportable. And so beer began to grow up in the cities. The temperance movement cruised right along around the 1830s and 1840s. You found temperance movements going into Ohio and West Virginia, chopping down whole apple orchards. Of course, two-thirds of the apple orchards that existed were for making hard cider. So, I mean, they knew what they were doing. But those two things managed to combine to destroy really the first beverage of North America and replace it by beer. And then it took another 100 years before wine made much of an impact. And, of course, there was always good bourbon around. But that's from something else. Moving right along, have we got the Hawkeye Red Delicious chopped up? Well, we do. Okay. No, these are not yours. Okay. This is what I was talking about before. It's a Hawkeye. It was called the Hawkeye, and the Stark brothers, when they started marketing it in the last century, sort of said Hawkeye might be good for James Fenimore Cooper, but it's probably not a good name to sell apples. And so they named it the Red Delicious after having a national contest to decide what the name of this wonderful new apple should be. And that's why I have Red Delicious. The stores you see, the Red Delicious you see in the stores are usually some version of something called a Star King, which comes from Washington State and is as beautiful as it can be and as tasteless as you can imagine. Now, here's a few, this one too? Okay, we probably have to move right along so that we can get to moonshine, which is coming, you've already had that one. Let me pass some more. Okay, you've already had this one? Yeah. Pass it on back, if you would. Next are two apples that you don't see very much at all. Again, old-fashioned kinds of apples. This is called a razor russet from the man who is two ridges away from us, who happened to have it. It looks like a russet. It tastes like a russet. Genetically, it is not a russet. Genetically, it is a Golden Delicious that went through a mutation in the same way that all other creatures mutate. And it is a bit pear-like. All russets are a bit pear-like. It's sort of an anomaly. Why, when it doesn't have the right gene code, it could turn out to taste like one. But it does. And we'll do it next. Some of you may know, okay. The evaluation sheets? Oh. Well, I figured them out. I don't know where they are. Okay. This next one is also a russet, and it's called a golden russet. And it comes more or less from England, and it might be the 16th or 15th century in England. It came to this country in the 17th. These apples our neighbors always called these apples rusty coats. And that is the traditional Appalachian term for them. The bigger, softer one is a golden russet. The crisper, tighter fleshed one, you can sort of see when you get them, is a razor russet. The golden, there are a whole bunch of russets. There's Golden's russet, there's St. Edmund's russet. There are about a half a dozen russets. And there's a small band of us who would like to see russets come back because we think they're great apples. But they don't look like movie star apples. And that's their problem. Now, The next, and it won't go very far, this is another crab. This is the Hughes crab that I mentioned that was one of Jefferson's favorite apples for making hard cider. There is a bit of a mystery that I talk about here that's Tom Burford's mystery, the aforementioned Tom Burford. Jefferson's absolute favorite cider apple was called the Tolliver, otherwise known as the spelled Taliaferro. And there's been a kind of, amongst apple sleuths, a rather exotic group. People have been searching all over the mountains, and he and we may have found the guy in southern West Virginia who has four or five trees and won't let you take more than three or four and is guarding them with his life, or they may not be. Jefferson, in a bit of overstatement, to my mind, once wrote that it was finer than that the cider that he made on his orchard from the Taliaferro, the Tolliver, was finer than the finest Chardonnay he'd ever drunk in Paris. There are times, it seems to me, when Mr. Jefferson should be taken with a large block of salt, but apparently it was good. And after that, we're going to do an apple that I'll be interesting to see what you think about. This one is a relatively new apple that comes from a Russian strain. It's called Redfield. It has red flesh. It has red leaves. It has red bark. It'll probably make you pucker up a bit. It's really only for making hard cider, and it's full of tannin. But it does make an excellent hard cider. How are we doing for time, John T? 5. Well, let's rush through these apples as quickly as we can here. This is all right. All right. Is that still? Yeah?
All of them.
The one that's coming out now is called a Chesapeake. It's the only apple I had here today that comes from our farm and our farm alone because it was what's called a sport or a genetic mutation of a Rome Beauty. Rome Beauties, the ones you'll see in the supermarkets now, are big and red and smooth, and they bake okay, but they taste kind of like sawdust. This one's a little better. And we thought we were going to be rich as Croesus when we discovered it and sold it to a nursery in Maryland that called it a Chesapeake. A few years later, the nursery went bankrupt. I'm going to pass some cheese out just to have something to cut against the apple. You've had too many apples. Just something, low-grade palate clearing. Let's see what we have over here now. Yep, spits and okay.
I mean, this is all these five plates.
Oh, really?
I can get four plates going.
Okay. Next comes another Jefferson favorite, the Spitzenberg, a difficult apple to grow, thought to be a parent of the Jonathan, came from somewhere in New York State, but Jefferson also liked it as well. We're an awful lot of Jefferson here, but I'm skewing it toward that part of the world. Isophis Spitzenberg, presumably German. And this is the first time we've planted 12 dwarf trees, and fire blight, which is a bad disease in this part of the world, and that part of the world, hasn't killed them yet. Any more spitzes? And what do we have over here? Black twig. All right. Let's do the King David's. The one that's coming out now is called King David. It also has a relation to Jonathan. Biblical country. It's my all-time favorite apple of apples. It's very high in sugar and very acidic. King David. Nobody grows it anymore because after about 10 years in the ground, it starts developing diseases and the fruit doesn't last very well. It's one of those things when you look at all the, we get nostalgic and rosy about all those wonderful apples there used to be. And you start asking growers why they don't grow them, it's because by the time the tree's old enough to start making money on it, it starts getting sick. But while it lasts, it's great. Has anybody ever had a good Golden Delicious? Oh, good. From the supermarket? West Virginia. These are Golden Delicious. Golden Delicious came from a tree on the side of the Ohio River near Parkersburg, West Virginia, sometime in the early years of the last century. As far as I can tell, if it's grown anywhere, I mean, it's the great one of the two great Appalachian apples. If it's grown anywhere other than on the hills of the Appalachian Mountains or a little bit in lower New York State, it's really putrid, as far as I can tell. And it's the basic lesson of French winemakers. Sun and soil, sun and soil, sun and soil. You ain't got it, you're not going to get it. I think it's a fantastic apple there, but nowhere else. And the ones in France are even worse. And where's our Grimes? Have we done Grimes? Okay. And following the Golden Delicious are that other great Appalachian apple, very hard to find these days. The father mother, I mean, it depends upon which tree you had, which side of the gene pool, called the Grimes Golden. And Golden Delicious is probably a seedling of Grimes Golden. Grimes Golden is sort of squat and tangy and gets a waxy yellow skin. But it's not very productive and doesn't make much money. Lastly, what do we have here? I can't tell by... Well, it's not what it says it is.
Stamen?
No, stamen.
Is this stamen?
That one is. Let's forget the stamen. Yorks. Almost to the end here. Not all the ones on your sheet are going to... We're running out of time here. This is called York Imperial. In the days of canned apples, almost every canned apple you were likely to have bought was a York Imperial from Upper Virginia and Lower Pennsylvania. It was also called the lock-jawed apple or the whop-jawed apple because the stem tends to grow about like that. And it's got a deep indentation on the bottom and on the top. And anything else we got here? No. Ah, black twigs.
Yep.
This will be the last one before we move on to liquor. This is called a black twig, which is likely... Well, there's a debate about the black twig. Tom Burford says it comes from Tennessee. Other people say it comes from Arkansas, but it's probably related to a wine sap. May not be quite ripe here. It usually comes in around the 10th of October or the 20th. So, any questions anybody has so we can wrap up? Yes?
Were there any wine saps? Did you bring wine saps?
In our cutting process, I think we got some of our wine saps crossed with other things. And so they're kind of mixed in here, and we ran out of time. Now, there are a bunch of wine saps. The oldest wine sap is another Virginia apple. It's called Virginia wine sap. We call them old-fashioned wine saps. They never get bigger than that. A variety of them was produced in Washington State with another kind of name. Wine saps were killed off by Red Delicious in the marketplace because Red Delicious would stay crisp in cold storage and wine saps wouldn't. What came after the wine sap, there was a Turley wine sap, and then there's the one that everybody loves is the Stamen wine sap. The problem with the Stamen wine sap, which made the Bird family very rich in the upper Piedmont of Virginia, is that when you move to smaller trees and a slightly warmer climate, it cracks open in August after you've had 3 weeks of drought and a heavy rain, and nobody wants a cracked apple, and it doesn't stay as crisp. One of the things that's changed in the last 40 years is that in the 1950s, people, and even today in Europe, people don't care if the apple is so crisp. Now everybody wants first crisp, second juice, and third flavor. They do these taste tests over and over and over. First crisp, which is why they like Granny Smith, which to my mind has no taste at all, but other people do like it. But it is crisp and it is juicy. And if it fails the taste test, well, there you have it. But that's the Stamen is a disappearing apple and likely will disappear except as an exotic in heritage orchards or crazy orchards like ours, where it is the number one apple among our people that come to see us. Anybody got anything they want to say about apples?
What's the story with Mutsu?
They come from Japan. They don't last very long. They got great flavor. They're big as pumpkins. And they're difficult to grow. And everybody loves them. But you've only got about 2 weeks to move them or they're a disaster.
Yes, ma'am.
In Washington State, we often had Gravenstein apples that were real good for homemade applesauce. Where do they fit in the spectrum of all of these?
Gravenstein come from the 16th, 17th century England. In England, they're a solid red. In California, and I suspect Washington State, they're striped, although I don't know. They're the big apple in California. They come in August. We can't sell apples that come in August very well, so we don't have any. But yeah, that's where it is in the apple story. And it tastes very different in England than it does here. Now, one of the things we're trying to do on the farm is start a small hard cider business, but we're using high tannin, bitter, but very sweet apples. And they all come from varieties in England or in Normandy or Brittany, where the climate and the soil is completely different. So it's a crapshoot. I don't really know whether they'll survive in the climate or what they're going to taste like exactly. But we're hopeful. There's going to be some hard cider I made 2-3 years ago that's here tonight. That's made from dessert apples. Generally, not a good idea, but we tried to find as much tannin as we could because the proper... It's kind of like trying to make a good wine from Concord grapes. You know, you do the best you can. Oh, it's for your own purposes. You keep them. It's just for your own sense of thinking about the apple varieties.
Yeah, I just quickly wondered if you had opinions about the best pie apple, the best sauce apple, the best baking apple, that sort of thing.
Well, as you might imagine, I do. And there is a big divide that's almost as big as Baptists and High Episcopalians. Then this little cookbook I did called An Apple Harvest that I did with a friend in California. She is Portuguese-Italian, and it's to peel or not to peel. I'm of the school that says you should not waste good things, and peeling is an awfully good thing, unless it's on a certain few apples where the peeling is so leathery like a black twig that you can't do it. So, always Edward, in the early fall, Jonathan, because it's tart, golden, delicious, if they're ours, because they're nutty and sweet and crisp and hold their shape, and something that's aromatic. If you were in the Northeast, it might be a Mac. Down here, it might be a Cortland. If you could find a Spitzenberg, that'd be great too. Anything that's perfumey. Red Delicious, even the Hawkeyes, I kind of stay away from. But that it's that mixing of flavors. So you get texture, something that sauces up a little, like a Cortland or a Mac or most of the tart apples, except for Jonathan, sauce up. That's what the acid does to the cell structure of the fruit. And so you mix all those together and keep the peeling on, and that's what I would... That's my 10 cents worth. My collaborator, Sharon, tells me it's absolute heresy to leave the peeling on, and so sometimes we'd make compromises. And she had her 50% and I had mine.
Thank you.